Hey everyone, this is an exciting episode for me because I'm going to be talking to one of the most innovative, legendary hip-hop artists of all time. He's a founding member of a tribe called Quest. He's also an actor, a musician, a producer, a DJ, and probably one of the most wonderful human beings out there in the world. Thank God for him. I'm honored because he doesn't do a lot of interviews. This is my friend, Q-Tip. Hey, this is Q-Tip. Kamal is one of the greatest musicians we know out there. I think you're so extraordinary in all that you do.
That's not true.
It's true. It is true. It is true. What are you? So are you? You're home.
Can you see me?
Yeah, now I can see you. Gosh, do you know that? You know what I rewatched and I hadn't seen in a long time, and I think it really needs to get back out there. Prison Song.
Oh Lord!
Your film Prison Song.
No,
this is a really important film, and I don't know. Like, if people haven't seen this movie in this time right now, that's a film to actually Netflix needs to have up center, and we've got to see it. It's such an important film, and I've seen it a long time ago, but that first shot with that director of yours.
Oh my God.
That movement, like it just kept going and going into the bus with the kids. I mean, that's one of the great long.
She was trying to get her Truffaut on, but I co-wrote it with Darnell. Okay, well, I kind of wrote it, and then we went and we did it with Bob and Jane at Tribeca.
Yeah.
So it was cool. It was like it was very advantageous, I guess, you know, but. You know, we tried to do a little thing, and you know, it has its place in the annals of hip hop filmography, if such a thing.
I think it's an important film, and I actually really enjoyed it. And your performance and your work and Mary J. Blige is in it. All the work
it was fun. It was a cute film. It was, but like you said, the message was really. That's what we were really trying to go for, you know.
A woman.
Because Jane Rosenthal from Tribeca, everybody who listens out there, we produced it with Robert De Niro and Jane
Rosenthal
at Tribeca. And she called me recently and was like, we need to maybe do that now. I think it's probably right now. It's probably time to kind of really do it for real. Because of everything that's happening, you know?
That's what I thought, because I saw it a long time ago. I think when it first came out, I might have seen it in a film festival or something. And then I said, you know, I got to rewatch that film. And I was really happy that I did. And also the score is great. Utopia. Are you Utopia too?
Utopia. When you say Utopia, are you talking about Todd Rundgren?
No, the score says, wasn't the score?
I didn't have nothing to do with the score. She went and Darnell sourced that out, and you know.
Well, that was a mistake. You should have been done the
well,
music.
Yeah, you know. I mean, hey,
that doesn't make any sense for
her
you.
Her and I bump heads.
No,
creatively. Like
that didn't make sense. You should have scored that movie. And I thought, okay, well, he must have had something.
All right.
All right. So let me talk to you.
Who are you?
How am I?
No, I just saw. I just was the other night.
Yeah.
I was just surfing or whatever, and Pulp Fiction was on it. and I was like, oh, I'm going to be speaking to her.
Yes. a whole nother lifetime of, but that movie sure still.
Can I just say that you're just amazing? You, your whole family, your dedication to your craft. I'm just honest, like real talk. You know what I'm saying? Like, I've been doing this for a while, so. Like I think we were saying before, we exist in a fraternity, right, of great artists, you know, whether it be Josephine Baker or Paul Robeson or Brando or whomever, and I'm just so sincerely, like, just humbled to coexist with you and your wonderful family and just, you know, doing the work that you've done, you know.
Oh, come on. That means so much to me. I really, you know, it's funny because I know that you were raised by, you know, good parents, and your father was like into jazz, and mm-hmm. you were inspired by him, and then you made a choice later in life to become a Muslim. My parents became Muslim when I was a kid. So I was raised among, you know, with many religions. My mom was a Jew. My father was Christian. And then they became Muslim. And so we were raised with all religions. They changed their name to Muslim names. We had Ramadan. Like, you know, this was kind of a thing that, like, I was interested in talking to you about, but there's so much to talk to you about, and I could talk for hours, and I'm so ADD, but I want to...
No, well, we could just do it all.
Yeah, right? I mean, first tell me a little bit, you know, just about how you grew up, and then, you know, I know that when you met, you know, your tribe, and Fife, and everybody, and you guys were young kids, and you met in church at 2 or something, and then you started rapping like together and writing together like early, like kids, like 9, 10, right? You started rhyming?
Yeah, that was crazy. you know, growing up in New York City in the 70s is what it was, you know what I mean? And the music in schools was starting to be, you know, take music programs in New York City schools. They had a big thing, you know, in the 60s, where they started to, like, redirect the curriculums. So we didn't really have, you know, because, you know, you had to have a higher, you know how these things go. You have, if you live in a district where the income is X amount, the schools obviously are better. You know, you go to another neighborhood where the schools aren't as good. So in those neighborhoods, arts was the first thing to go.
Yeah.
Luckily, you know, we had hip hop. So that was like our kind of early thing at 9 and 8 was the first rap record was. And these were cats that when we were like 6, 7, you know, you'd hear people before a recorded rap record, you'd hear people, you know, kind of rapping, and you see DJs set up and they have block parties. It was a New York thing, you know? So that's how we got to it so early, just being, it was like a craze. It was, I wasn't alive then, but I could liken it, and I'm sure, I know you weren't either, but it's like if The Twist came out and Chubby Checker and just like a phenomenon, or like when I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles, it was a phenomenon.
Right.
Or when, I don't know, Salt Peanuts with Charlie Parker came out, phenomenon, right?
Yes.
So the hip. Hop, pivoted, and it was just like, you know what I mean? So that's why we did it so early. That's why we got to it so early, because, you know, we were at that impressionable age, and we were very industrious, you know, and we were very serious. I remember Fife, God bless his soul, he was like, you know, I'm a few months older than him, but he was just always the short, kind of mouthy, and he was like, man, you know, if Run DMC, if Rapper's Delight could do it, then we could do it. And then when Run DMC and those guys came out, like around 82, which was a few years after, we were 12, 13, then we were just like, okay, let's go.
Do you have all that footage? Like, do you have like recordings of the little, like, you know, tape recordings of that time?
I used to have, I had like the first demos when I was writing when I was 14, 15, when I wrote Bonita Applebum and all that stuff on the first album, a lot of that when I was 15. Huh. I had that stuff, but then I lost it all in a fire. I had a horrible fire in my townhouse. Lost a lot of that stuff, a lot of the tribe stuff.
And demo. Oh, no.
I wish I had it.
That's terrible. Yeah. And, when you actually formed Tribe Called Quest, the official band, how old were you then?
We were 15.
It was 15. But were you signed then?
No, we were shopping, and we got signed on But I started. We started putting out records when we were like 17, 18, and got officially signed when we were 18. 1988, yeah, 18.
And were you signed by, what was your first label?
Jive.
It was Jive.
Yeah, which was, at the time it was called Jive RCA.
Yep.
And they had Houdini on the label, and Fresh Prince, Will Smith, was on the label, and Boogie Down Productions, KRS-One, was on the label.
What I always loved about your music, and I love about your music, is just that it's like it really just took this what's going on in the world socially in a way, and you know, it's just the marriage of what's happening socially and poetry, and then this sound that is unique and it is yours. And I think so many people were influenced by you, including, by the way, I have to say, as much you made it, Prince. I think he was influenced by you guys. I do.
I think you got it wrong.
It's the I don't know.
Never. That's like Prince is just like, he's such a, oh my goodness.
But he was watching you. He was listening to you.
It was funny. No. We had a great relationship. I remember when he was, he had started the New Power Generation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were all working on Graffiti Bridge or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So he reached out. They reached out to me, and because he was starting a radio station, I think, at the mm-hmm. time, like a pirate radio station, and he reached out to me and was coming to New York. And we spoke on the, he called me and we spoke on the phone. He called me like 2 a.m. Hey man, I really love you, the stuff that you guys do.
Yeah,
I'm coming to New York. I hope to see you then. And I was like, okay, well, it was great. He's like, yeah, okay, and hangs up the phone. So then a couple weeks later, he calls and he's at the Apollo, and he's doing like a thing, like one of his hit and run shows, and they're doing. I guess they had that song. It was the one after. It was Get Off and Cream and all that stuff.
Okay,
so it was that one. I met him on Graffiti Bridge. We had that little conversation. So it was actually, that's right. It was probably a year or so after he came to town.
Was Wendy and Lisa in that record?
Wendy and they weren't in the band at that time.
They were done. Okay.
Yeah. So then he was at the Apollo, and I came in, and then he was doing 1999. But sometimes, you know, when you're hitting live,
mm-hmm.
you don't necessarily do recorded tempo, you do show tempo, so it's like and I'm like, no, it's like too fast, and I just come out to Apollo, I'm like, put it up, Bob. He does turn around, slide, and runs off the stage. He says, come later. And there's a limo right by the door. He slides off the side of the stage. His guy puts a coat over him, and he hops in the limo. The doors open, and he drives off. And I'm like,
oh, my God.
But he was a dear, dear friend. And we you know, we worked on some stuff together, and he would always, the conversations we had with him were crazy. But he surprised me a couple of times. He was like, when we were working on one of my solo albums, he came to a couple of the shows, and then he hopped up on stage with me on one song. I had no idea, and it was just like, you know, you're still pinching yourself.
Yeah.
It's like him and Stevie. It's like you pinch yourself, you're like, and of course, De Niro, you see them, and you're like, oh, God.
Yeah,
kind of these guys, you know what
right.
I mean?
Right, right. So, I almost did Under the Cherry Moon.
So much, but.
No, this is about you.
Oh, yeah, it's a podcast.
This is a podcast, and I'm interviewing, but I wanted to tell you that I almost did Under the Cherry Moon. He wanted me to do that movie. And this is a long, long time.
Hell, you should have did it.
Well, you know, Kristen Scott Thomas did it, and she was, you know, she did. at the time there was, it was like I in that state where, you know, and then I had people and they say, no, that's not right for you and you shouldn't do it. And I always kicked myself about it. But when he did invite me to the premiere, which ended up being an MTV award, they chose somebody who won this contest in their hometown. And it was, I think it was Jackson in Wyoming or something. And, and he flew Joni Mitchell and I to the premiere.
Another one. Joni. Oh my God. I love her.
Well, she's me too. And that's why I know I love Joni so much. And we flew together. And then I never got to do it. And I used to shoot the backstage interviews for Coachella. And he played.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, for 6 years. And I was supposed to interview him. And then his handler was really pissed off, like, because I just usually just go up to say, hey, hi, you know, I'm Arizona Kid.
Right, right, right.
And usually people would just, no one, you know, everybody would do it. But his handler was like, and then he just killed it. And he was so, and I remember him just looking at me like, oh, hey, you know, like, and then he kept going and I didn't get that interview. And I was so bummed.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But anyway, tell me everything that's going on with you right now, because we're just dealing in this crazy world right now. And I think music has always been for me.
Wait, but how's Joni doing?
Joni's doing okay. She's really doing well.
You have to tell her that I love her so much.
I will.
And please just send her, like...
Do you know her?
Love, no.
Well, so you guys need to connect. And we should also do that, by the way, with your, you know, with Mike Lawson, who's, you know, my old great friend, and your...
Friends, everybody out there listening, the Austin family, so we don't get you too much in the weeds.
Yeah,
hello, everybody. I'm here to recap. Let's recap.
Mo Austin signed Frank Sinatra and Jimi Hendrix.
Right. Okay, next thing.
And Michael, you know, is one of the great, great manager, great ears, great human being, and a great old friend of mine for 20, I think we're going on 40 years. What am I talking about? I like to say 40 years.
And I see your Sly shirt.
And I did that just for you.
I see, you know,
Sly and the Family Stone, I wore that for you because we talked about Sly and the Family Stone before. And
yeah, I know.
Did you meet him?
I have his board. I spoke to him on the phone, but I never met him. I've seen him perform.
Yeah.
It's kind of great. You was telling me you saw him perform a few times, right?
I saw him, and then, you know, the last time he played at Coachella, and because I was shooting the backstage, I was like, oh, I really want that interview, but he was having a... It was a little moment, you know, there where it was just like, it was just too much. And I think he's just, you know, he's an empath. He's like, feels all the energy, and people were like, and he kind of came out and just stared at everybody, and the band was playing and he didn't really play. And I just felt this energy from him. Like, it was like a sadness. It was like, I don't know what it was, a fear. But so I went up to the stage, and because I had the access to be right there on the front of the stage, I was like, we love you. We love you. And I just kept screaming, we love you. And then getting people to say, we love you, so he could feel the love. And then he came to the end of the stage and sat there and just held my hand. And, you know, and I said, we love you. Everybody loves you, please. You know, and he goes, what do you want to hear? And I said, the first thing that came to my mind, and I don't know why, but because there's so many songs, but I just said, Hot Fun in the Summertime.
Right.
And he sang it. And then I think another song. And then he just, like, you know what? He just looked at everybody and kind of said he had enough. And he's one of the greatest, greatest musicians ever. I love his work. It was my childhood, was his albums, you know, so.
D'Angelo just sent me last night. He Mary J. Blige and Michael Jackson do a Hot Fun in the Summertime for the LeBron James Space Jam movie that's coming out this summer.
What?
Yeah, and it's incredible.
I got to hear that.
Incredible.
Yeah. Wait a minute. So Michael Jackson, who had recorded that a long time ago,
Michael recorded it. I actually remember because Mary, she came to my studio to record her vocals. It was Mary, Michael, and D'Angelo.
So, but they didn't. They did it when Michael's vibrant. He had recorded it himself, and they cut it into it.
Michael started the track. But D'Angelo did the track, and then Michael recorded to it. Then Michael passed, and then they decided to get married. So Mary came by here and cut her vocals here. And then they just finished it last night and they're going to put it. It's like a 20-minute song.
I want to hear that so much. You know, I used to also be friends with Michael years ago because I was around for the Thriller album a lot because at the time I was with Steve Porcaro, who wrote Human Nature, and I was friends with
him. Oh, my God, what a song. That's like the best. That's his best song.
So that was
weren't their brothers, Porcaro?
Yeah, the Porcaros, Jeff Porcaro, who passed away, and Steve is alive, but we were together at the time, and so I was in the studio all the time, and I was friends with Michael, and he would just go, you know what, your real name, you're Tinkerbell. And so that's every time he would see me, he'd go, hey, Tinkerbell, and I'm thanked on the record, actually, but I did.
Really?
Yeah. It says Steve
and Rosanna. Backgrounds on any of those?
It says Steve Rosanna Porcaro. I wasn't married to him, but for some reason he just probably assumed I was, but it says Steve Rosanna.
Oh, my goodness. You have that effect on people.
but we were good pals, and, you know, it's all really sad, everything that turned out, because he was a great musician.
I hope this is not too like laughing, like non sequitur. Like I hope our whole interview right now is not so like one liner. I'm not taking you off.
Me? Well, I'm just. This is what it is. Like we're just flowing. Really? Okay. Is that okay with you?
It's great with me.
Yeah, because I don't do that. Okay. I just have a conversation. Like, there's a million questions here, and I come out even looking at them, because I always have them just in case I get lost in something, just to make sure that I'm, you know, doing the right thing. But I do like to just have a conversation and see where it goes, right?
Yes. I'm so sorry, because I like to, you know, chit-chat with you. So.
Well, this is what we're doing. We're chit-chatting, and then it also is... Yeah. And it's a way for people to also know you in a way that maybe they don't. I didn't know, and something that I just discovered, I didn't know that you actually teach at the music school, Clive Davis Music School. Are you a professor?
No.
Can I start calling you professor? Kamal?
No, you know, I was thinking about it because they called me again. I'm talking about all these calls I'm getting. Let's see, I've had 3 calls conversations since we started. I'm sorry, that's my mind.
But that's okay.
They called the Jason King, and they want me to come back and do it, like to come on as a staff, you know? And I'm like, I don't know. I want to do it, definitely, but I don't know. I think I still have some chapters of my own to write before I...
Really? I don't know. I think if you did a semester, a year, I mean, so maybe it's just even like the 3-month thing, and you just commit to something like that, what you're doing, it's still,
I had a good idea for a syllabus, but then I started like working on it and stuff. So I don't know.
You might discover the next amazing prodigy and be able to help them. And maybe that's part of the thing where you're you're still in the, you know, you're teaching and you're also creating. I think it could be powerful.
Yeah.
I think it could be powerful.
I enjoyed it, though, when I did it. So I probably go back, but it was really great, you know, to be able to do that.
I think I'm going to change your name. It's Professor Kamal. The professor, which it could be a whole new record, and maybe that's what it is. It's the professor and the people that you discover in that 3 months, and maybe that's what it is. It's like actually they bringing you their work.
They used to do back in the days, they used to do albums, music schools from different, you know, universities around the country. They would do like, you know, the Bowling Green woodwind band with featuring the, you know, the Piscataway, such and such and such, you know what I mean? Like, they would have these little albums that would come out on these. And I don't know, that could be good.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing that's the beauty of it is that it's like you could just do a semester. So it's like a special class that everybody would be probably, it would be huge and people would want to be a part of it. But maybe it's just 3 months. You know, it's not the whole year. Just, you know.
Yeah.
And do it like that. Especially now that because of COVID and everything, it's really all, I have so many great musician friends. Some of my best friends are all musicians, and for them not to be able to go on the road and tour right now, this is like, we don't have music festivals. We don't have live music. We're not going into the play. I feel like so depressed by it, because I realize that's such a huge, huge part of my life.
I don't know. I think I'd rather have like food and water, and, you know, some necessities before I get to music. You know what I mean? Like, although music, it's definitely, you know, what it is. But I think that, you know, just looking at the where we've been for the last, I don't know, 18 months or so, it's just been really the last 4 years.
The 4 years were the worst things that ever happened to maybe the world, but it is the president of the United States, the ex-president, if you can call him that, Trump, and what he did and how he's destroyed everything on every level.
It really puts everything into context. And, you know, music was just like, you know, yeah, I do it, but I could chill. It's all right. You know what I mean? Because it was just about like our rights and our liberty, and you know, all of that was just been seriously impeded upon. You know?
It has. I mean, systematic racism. Of course, I don't have to explain that to anybody. But for me, growing up, and I'm white, and so lived. Even though I grew up extremely poor, and my mother was an activist and worked with, you know, Fred Hampton, Chairman Fred, and, you know, in the kitchens in Chicago and peace marches. And like, I was around social justice, and my mom put together a march with Martin Luther King. And this was like instilled in my whole being. I guess all of us in America, you know, when we all experienced with our own eyes and ears the murder of George Floyd, which happens, you know, daily, all the time. But we saw this, we heard this, and it went into our, anybody who's a human being, our and the Black Lives Matter movement, which is such an important movement, and that peacefully, beautiful protests that happened all across the country, which were not violent, were not filled with, you know, it was, if anything came, that you could see that the people, they were white supremacists actually creating the violence to make it look like this was Black Lives Matter doing it, and they were not doing it. Anyway, I'm going on and on. And tell me how you have been dealing with this right now in this time.
Yeah, I know, right? It's hard to find a word, right?
This culture, for me.
This, I mean, it's been, you know, all you could do is just take it a day at a time. And thankfully, you know, look, I'm super blessed, right? Because you and I are kind of like, you know, we exemplify the idea of what it is to the American dream, right? Being a woman, being an African-American man, but still kind of following our notions and our passions and becoming, I guess, what we've became, for lack of a better word. And it's, we have first world problems. So when this thing hit us, sure, we couldn't go do the yoga. We couldn't go to spin class. We couldn't get on the private plane to go to this place or whatever. But I'm fine. I handled it fine. But I was just so like, what automatically kicked in, I think, not only for me, but for folks like you, is to, well, what can we do? We have to become active. Well, how can we affect, how can we use the fact that we have access to this plane and our Rolodex is so mighty and hefty and we have these relationships? How can we leverage this right now in real time to really affect the change? So, I've been doing that, you know, quietly, just been, you know, was put together a little coalition, and we spent hours and hours Zooming. I did so much reading and just getting up to speed on everything that was happening, not only from the pandemic aspect, but then from the whole George Floyd incident, the Breonna Taylor incident.
Oh, God.
You know, just really trying to leverage all of our all of our goodwill and currency to try to affect the change as much as ever. But I didn't want to do it because, you know, we're polarizing too, right? Yeah. Because, you know, oh, look at these liberals, these artistic liberals think they could, you know, fine. And some of it is warranted, some of it not so, but so be it. We know the playing field. I wanted to kind of do it. I guess this is the first time I'm talking about it to anybody that I was kind of working behind the scenes, because I didn't really want to be on Front Street with it. And to keep to that, you know, being a good friend, I'll mention that, but I won't get into the things that I did. But that's how I spent a lot of my time also, and then caring for mom, and then kind of going star crazy, you know what I'm saying? Like having cabin fever, and just, I just hope that they just, this impeachment thing never gets on. It just seems like his whole, I don't know what he's doing on his legal team. Did he put anything together?
Whoever they are, their names sound like porn stars. I don't like Butch somebody. The whole thing is just like, what is going on here? Who are these people? One of them, was the last attorney that came into the cell of Jeffrey Epstein. So there, you know, there you go. Those are his people, the lowest of the low. And I, and then the movement, because we clearly are seeing there's no such thing as the Republican Party anymore, which, I mean, I'm a long time.
Yeah, what's your views on that?
I'm not a Republican. But whatever was once the people that, the John McCain's of the world, who, you know, we didn't agree with John McCain or anything, but a guy like that, or the guys in the Lincoln Project who left the Republican Party who actually believed in democracy, and like there were some at least honorable in that area of like the Constitution, or, you know, following these things that we all fought and died for, a lot of people have for democracy. And whatever this new, it's all based on racism, the Q thing. It's all based on systematic racism, which was how this whole country was built, unfortunately. And we're trying to dismantle that. But these people are keeping it in the front and center in a way that is so extraordinarily dangerous.
It's the crazy thing about it is racism is birthed from. It's a strain of capitalism. It's out of capitalism. Really capitalism. Mm-hmm. It's really about money. Mm-hmm. And racism is just a facade kind of that just was thrown, a hefty facade that had that caught, you know, it's maniacal and kind of devious, but it's like one of those like ingenious, you know, one of those evil guys. We have like this brain, like whoever came up with it. Like, so it's like been used to really leverage capitalism, but of a democracy, and we all know democracy is a fragile as fuck. What other democracy is out there, really? You know what I'm saying? Like, democracies don't fucking, if they're around, they don't last, and they're rare. You know, it's like being a cuckoo or something. You know what I mean? So,
but you're seeing that Kyle Rittenhouse.
You know, what'd you say that again?
I was going to say that just recently that, you know, this kid, the 17-year-old kid that murdered two people with his gun, except his mother driving him with his, and then he gets off and now they can't find him and bail. And then they pepper spray a 9-year-old black child. You know, this shit is like this. It makes me feel like
fucking wrong. It's
so horrible. Wow. It's horrible.
And the dudes who do that, who actually, the actual guys, I'm not saying all cops, but the guys who actually do that, if you're macing a 9-year-old fucking kid.
Yes.
If you're fucking pulling up on a 12-year-old boy in Cleveland outside playing by himself with his toy gun and you're shooting him from your car, you're a fucking pussy. I'm sorry.
All,
but that's punk shit. You know what I'm saying?
There are white supremacists now are infiltrating the military, infiltrating our police force. It's like these guys like it need to be weeded out. It's like restructuring the police force. We need to get them out. They cannot be. No way.
What nation have you known to really fall prey to like a great sovereignty like this, right? Like one of the superpowers of the world. And think about in all of history, what country that has this superpower tag to it? Roman Empire, Ming Dynasty, whatever, has fallen from a threat from another nation.
I mean, yes, we've fallen from Russia. They've been doing it for you. Huh?
Like, think about it. Seriously.
Right now? I mean, fallen from...
These great sovereignties, usually I'm sure you could find an example, but don't they fall at the hands of their own?
Well, it's happening in India right now. Modi is a fascist. It's happening India is happening. Starting to happen in the UK.
Happened to the UK back in the 1400s.
Yep.
1500s. They had to kick motherfuckers out of there, right?
Yeah.
Am I right? Then half of them, where did they go? They had one half of the degenerates from the UK went to Australia, and the other half came to America, right? Like, I mean, look at it. Like, they always fall into hands of their own. And I feel like, although it would have been nice to have a little bit more time in this motherfucker. I mean, it's only been like 500 years or 600 years old. It would have been nice to get at least 2,000-3,000. But it feels like it's kind of like we're hanging on the thread on the ledge. Like, we're in the third act, hanging off the ledge. I don't know. Am I pessimistic?
No, because we're seeing right now. Look what happened with COVID.
You gotta help me understand this. You know what I'm saying?
I
feel like it's fucked.
It is fucked, especially what we're seeing with COVID right now. And we're seeing that the majority of the people that are actually dying from it because of their negligence and horrible how they handled it. You know, we're the country in the world that has worse than any place in the world who handled this. And the amount of black and brown and indigenous tribes that are just dying from COVID, to me, it's like, this was pointed. This was the intentional. There's something eugenics. What the fuck is this? It's horrible. And I've been really depressed, frankly. And we're all here in this collective PTSD. We had a moment. There was just this moment of hope for like a second. You know, Sean Ossoff, Raphael Warnock, they got in, and Georgia was like, "Well, Stacey Abrams, my God, thank you, God." And then you can't
even enjoy that.
I was making a peach pie. I was making a peach pie in the morning, and let me tell you, and then and then the sixth came, and then it was like, they're storming the fucking Capitol. Are you kidding me? Like, these crazy lunatics are rubbing their shit on the walls.
Oh, right.
They're
right.
Rubbing their shit on the walls. And it's like, this is, and the president of the United States has said, go do that. You go do that. You go kill these people. You go kill AOC. You go kill Nancy Pelosi. You even go kill Pence while you're at it too. Because, you know, he hasn't stuck up.
Petty Mike Pence.
They had guillotines. I mean, this shit cannot stand. I mean, we cannot be
fucking believable.
Right?
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. You don't even get a fucking second to fucking say, oh, to have a collective sigh of relief. The next day, these motherfuckers is out there doing meth.
Yeah.
And fucking beer bongs, smoking joints and shit in there.
Yeah.
Fucking Skinner is playing, bouncing off the fucking the
Sweet Home Alabama
and walls and shit.
Oh. I mean,
I like Skinner though. I'm not mad.
I after that, I don't think I slept for about 4 days in a row. I was like walking around in the most insane anxiety. And then when the inauguration happened this day, it was done very beautiful. It was like, okay, let's just, and I found myself praying all day. Just, let's just please. When Kamala came right there, and, Amanda, the beautiful poet, and wow. Just, and then he puts in Lloyd Austin, who's like a black man for the Pentagon. And he's like, he's trying to do this in a way that we can come together, but we can never, ever, ever unite ever with white supremacists. It's never going to happen.
Never. And you know why? And the whole thing, white supremacy, racism, all of this stuff, like we said, I think it's all kind of comes, they're fruits of capitalism, right? And mm-hmm. We were saying it's never going to get better as long as white supremacy and those kind of concepts and people who live them exist and are free to grow and just, you know what I mean? And it's going to happen because it's all privilege, mm-hmm. right? And like we were talking about, like, I liken privilege. You know, every infant has privilege when they're born, right? Because they get fed, somebody comes to them immediately, see what's wrong. We try to egg them on to laugh and smile. We have to feed them, we have to wipe them when they sit and they pee, and you take care of them. And with white folks, this is just an observation from a black man, but with white folks in this country, that privilege gets extended beyond infancy, because it's like you have the privilege,
yep,
to rear your children, that they and the ones who look and you faction with are the only ones that matter in existence, which is why gentrification has been a hot and heavy topic for what, 70 some odd years, and it's consistent of 50s, because when white folks move into black neighborhoods, they'll run down, you know, 137th Lennox, jogging past the Audubon where Malcolm was murdered. And, you know, they are looking for, you know, oh, well, I got to stop by Dwayne Reed. There's one black person that passed it, another black person that passed it, another black person that passed it, becomes a white person. Hello, do you know what a Dwayne Reed is? That's the example of gentrification and privilege that at its core is a problem, because you don't coexist with it. Humanity becomes frail and becomes trite, and it's only extended to people who not even look good. Look like you, but it's who get it. In the, I don't know if I'm making sense.
You are.
But white privilege, it's really, to me, it's really this thing that's like spoiled brats.
Yeah.
When you saw these guys get the QAnon, absolutely, guy who looked like Jamiroquai, only eats organic food, whatever his funny name is. I can't even mention his name, right?
It's just like, go fuck yourself.
They said that they are going to give him organic food in jail. Right?
Just
like these guys, when they go and they have a no-fly zone and you see videos of them, grown men in airports. Ah, I can't believe you treat me like this. Treat me like a black person. I'm just trying to fly home, and because I went to the Capitol, you're doing it. Babies.
Yeah.
Privilege.
Yeah. Yeah.
Babies. They are spoiled, rotten.
I agree.
And there's hope. The one little piece of hope, I think, is that humanity that they choose to exercise in certain situations and choose not to make it a broad sense of humanity. That humanity that escapes them to make them you know, not ask the 10 black people that walk past them and only ask that white. But that kind of humanity that they lack is the one thing that I think is the hope for them, you know? Underneath which situation, God only knows. But I think that that's the only hope. Other than that, I think we're fucked.
I do agree with you, actually. And I have a lot of shame, you know, because I am privileged. I am white, and I have a lot of shame about that.
I don't have no shame because you, Knowing is what? Half the what? Knowing is half the what? Battle, right? That's what they say.
It's a battle, but,
but you can't.
I talked about it.
If you didn't recognize that for yourself, if you had no idea, then that would be a different conversation. You should feel bad. Absolutely. The fact that you're kind of like aware of it.
I actually have a lot of guilt and shame about it. I do, because it is unfair. And I talked about it after the El Paso shootings. I said something, you know, on Twitter, and I said about being white and privileged, and I had said something about, you know, that about racism, this, you know, and how horrible this was, and this murders, and it was all white supremacy, and I have a lot of shame because I'm white and privileged, and I feel ashamed. And I got those Q people, like death threats, calling my managers, like just this slew of racism at me for saying that. Where to the point where, you know, we had to have an investigator to make sure that everything was cool. And I still stand by my words.
Because a lot of them are punks, though. They ain't going to do shit. Like, a lot of people who talk don't really do. A lot of them, it's a lot of barking. You have a few in there that'll bite.
Yeah.
Definitely. And you have some that are kind of coupled with the bark and the bite. There's a few. Anomaly. But most of them, it's a bunch of, like, you know, hubbub. And they just, you know... The thing about it is that the dangerous thing about that is that kind of hubbubaloo gets infectious, and it rolls around, and it spreads, and it gets, you know, viral. Whereas the internet has been, you know, I think one of the most important, you know, personifications of communication in the last 100 years, right? Because it's really made... I mean, we've made so much strides. It's made Global Village that much more knit. But at the same time, the darkness that happens there, you know.
I want to know right now, with everything that I know you're working behind the scenes and changing the world and many things, but are you making music in this time?
Yeah, I'm always working. So I have a couple of things that I'm trying to wrap up now. But yeah.
Have you ever thought about doing a musical? Like a real hip hop musical, with a great story, like really, really do it.
Yeah, we've been talking about doing something that's different from that, though, but kind of in that vein. We're kind of working on something now.
Oh, neat. I like to hear that. That's cool.
It should be cool. I'll tell you kind of.
Okay, we won't do it. We won't tell anybody here.
I'm trying to finish up some stuff. I've been having some music that I've been working on. I'm putting out 3 records.
Well, that's what I mean. This is great news. Okay. You're putting out 3 records?
Yeah.
Okay. And they're all.
But now, you know, it's funny because of the delivery system of everything now. Mm-hmm. It's really made it a little bit more wide open now in terms of you could do the albums, you could do singles, you could do a bundle of singles, you could do, so I'm just trying to play with how I'm gonna put them out and in which forms, and like they're not just gonna just solely be music. I'm still gonna I'm gonna do a little show with a couple of them because they're kind of themed. Like one is called Algorithm and it's spelled Algorythm.
I love it.
And the other one is called Riot Diary, or kind of like Doctor Strange Love or How Did We Learn How to Love the Bomb, but it's like Riot Diaries, what to do in case, you know, Riot Diaries, what to do in case your humanity gets jacked.
Ooh. What do we do? What do we do if our humanity is jacked, which it is being jacked right now? What are we going to do? What's the answer?
It's going to be in the diary. You're right.
It's going to play music.
You know, you take your pills, you drink your water, you eat your greens.
We can get some water to drink that's clean and not, you know, toxic.
You read a passage of something every day, you know.
That inspires you?
Yeah.
Do you read the Quran?
I do.
Mm-hmm. Is that what inspires you? Do you do your prayers? Do you do 5 times a day on prayers?
Not every day. I strive. As they say that when you're on your deen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my deen is kind of like struggle. It's a struggle. It's called jihad al-alta, the jihad of self.
Mm-hmm.
You have the good... The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam would say that the greatest jihad is the one with yourself.
My dad paid 5 times a day. He went to the he was a real Muslim and went to Mecca. Mm-hmm. And
I've yet to make my Hajj.
Hajj.
Yeah.
He brought me back jasmine, some amazing jasmine, you know. It was like, yeah.
They call it private stock from under the rock. When you somebody to bring you some scents from there. It's funny because I wrote a rhyme one time and it said, I said, I'm just a humble man, descended of the motherland. I fuck with blackberries and dimes with butter tan. Good on my right and troubles on my other hand. Life is a tightrope I'm dying to balance. You know, it's like, because if you're on a tightrope, if you slip, you may die, right? But that's what life is. It's a tightrope, and as soon as you're born, you're kind of dying, right? But you're dying to balance. I don't know if that makes
sense. No, it makes complete sense. And does the balance come from your spirituality to the connection of Allah, God, whatever you want to say, Mother Earth, whatever is higher for you? Some people, you're a Muslim, so it's Allah, but that core center of truth and love, which for me is God.
Yeah, I mean, look, the balance is that, first of all, you got to be able to deal with the fact that you're not perfect. And once you get past that, you can't beat yourself up. And then you're going to have to get the balance between beating yourself up, but still being stern, right, with yourself. Mm-hmm. There's balance there.
Discipline.
There you go. Then there's balance in, you know, joy and how much joy you're having in your life. You know what I'm saying? To balance, I think little ideas of balance are like cysts in the body. Like, we all have so many cysts in our body. It's a horrible analogy, but there's always pockets of balance all throughout all of us that we're trying to do every day. You know what I mean? You got to be able to
drink the water. Drink your water.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Enough, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes you got to you got to work out. Like, it's all just the rhythm of life all around us, the balance, you know, how plants give us what we eat and give back to them what they eat. Just balance, the personification of balance of life, but it's always just around, right? So that's my thing. You know, sometimes you fall off.
Yeah.
And it's
you're a vegetarian, right? You don't eat meat, animals?
I eat some fish.
Yeah.
I'll eat some chicken and fish.
Oh, you do a little chicken. Well, that's a bird. No, that's an animal.
Are you a vegetarian?
I for 15 years, I was solid vegetarian. Then I went off when I had my baby, who's now 26. So I go on and off. But right now in life, right now I am. But
sometimes don't you feel like you want some iron?
If
you want a burger sometimes, it's like when you're in Rome, do you just say, you know what? I haven't had a burger in 20 years. Maybe I have a little piece of bread if I felt like it.
So it's funny because my daughter never had meat until she was about 12. Mm-hmm. And then she said to Mom, I want a hamburger. And I was like, God, why? I shouldn't be telling her what's right for her body. Like, I raised her vegetarian. And so I remember this moment. So I was like, okay, I'm going to get her a great hamburger. Healthy one, as much as it was in New York, and she liked it. And now she's kind of finding her own way. But at that point, it wasn't for me to tell her what was right for her, you know. I know you're dealing, I don't know if it's okay, but we can cut this. With your mama, who's been ill. Mm-hmm. Is that okay to talk about?
Yeah. Because
I can cut this right now.
We need to. No. Okay. I, in fact, want to do something for dementia. I'm trying to work to, I just don't have any, but we could talk about that part off the record, but my mother, dementia, the strongest woman I've ever known, mm-hmm. Montgomery, Alabama, she's born, she's one of 15, and like any relationship, you know, it's like I lost my dad when I was 16, he passed, and my mother and father honored their vows, you know, they were kind of like old school and stuff. My mother never remarried. And,
was she?
With my heart, I'm able to take care of her, you know what I'm saying?
And it's and you're taking care of her in a great way. And so did your dad start to see your success? See what you were becoming?
No.
The writing and.
Well, he knew, my dad was an avid reader. He spoke like 3 or 4 languages. He spoke Latin, so he spoke German and Spanish and French.
Was he a teacher?
He was a soldier. He was in the Korean conflict, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he had a lot of trauma, too, from that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but he was dope, you know what I'm saying? Like, my mom's was amazing. Like, parents not perfect, but parent perfect, you know, in a weird way, you know what I'm saying? So, my mom just like her strength, you know, how she raised me and my sister, I just like, you know, she's just an amazing one. Just to think about a black girl in the 50s in Alabama and then get to New York, you know what I mean? Like, just I still think about it and I marvel, you know, when you're young and you take things for granted about your elders, but then when you start to get to there in those age range, you know, ages, you start to, you know what I mean? It just rings so true. So yes, my mom, she's doing great. Thank God. She's lucid. She's listening to her Bobby Blue Bland and her little Willie John and her Sam Cooke.
Are you making her playlist?
I made a playlist. Yeah.
Good. And
though, you know what I'm saying? Because it's hard to see her like that still. Yes. Still. And it's crazy.
It's your mama, of course.
Yeah. And it's crazy, like, the dementia thing. And, you know, shouts out to everybody out there who's listening, whose families who deal with, you know, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia. To all of you out there, like, know that, you know, there's a lot of wonderful people out there who, you know, you could look online to go call people to talk about, because the caretakers go through a lot of, it's not just the person who has it, but it's the children and caretakers of those. That's a lot. So my heart is with you all as somebody who deals with that. It's a different range of emotions, and I can admit it. Like, I've definitely gone through it. It's hard when your mother doesn't know who you are.
That's very, very painful. Both my parents died pretty young. My mother had cancer. My father had liver issues and ended up succumbing. And then Alexis, my trans sister, like, died. Mm-hmm. So that long time of taking care of someone who was ill, I understand that part of it.
Yeah.
And it is super painful. But it's interesting that, do you feel like when you put the music on, there's a connection to you when she...
The music is everything. Well, it's her connection is just solely to the music. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get as expansive as that, unfortunately, for when you're dealing with dementia and people of her age. But the wonderful thing about it is that synapses just wakens up when they hear and can say every word. Like the other day, you know, she's singing some, I don't know, Work With Me, Annie, Hank Ballard. Now I know the songs. Work with me, Annie. Let's get it by the getting. It's good, so good, so good, so good. You know, and she's singing all these words, and then King will come on, and she's like, or the spinners will come on, and she's like, you know, could it be I'm falling in love with you, baby? Singing all the words. But then I'm like, Ma, you know who I am? She's like, now who are you? And I chuckle sometimes, you know what I mean? But she just gets finished singing all of these words, these songs, and then doesn't know what. So it's funny at this point, you know what I mean? But it's cute and it's great. So sometimes I have to be like, you know, like Superstition was on and she was singing, Baby Superstition. I was like, Mom, are you singing this song? I said, you know what? I forgot. How do you spell superstitious, Mom? S-U-P-E-R-S-T-I-T-I-T-I-T-I-T-I-O-N. I was like, that's right, Ma, that's right. You know, so you have to, you know, you have to
keep her engaged. Keep her engaged in life and in the life force. So,
and the people I have work with me and from my assistants and my security, the people who are caretaking, they've just been so fabulous. And it's like that humanity that we were talking about a few minutes earlier, like it's such a vital source with this whole undertaking has taught me. It's like plasma. It's like water or humanity. It's like it should be an element that we should, it should be something that should be cared for and coddled and chipped away like the finest of stones. Humanity is just slipping, you know, and it's a precious thing.
It's the diamond inside that stone.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So like the humanity that everybody who's around her and sees her and touches her and cares, I can't express enough. I'm thankful. So who's your favorite Beatle?
John. Even though I was friends with and very close friends with McCartney, but I mean, that's terrible. They're both amazing artists together, and their music together are incredible. But I love so much the humanity and the activism of John Lennon so much, and Yoko together, what they did.
Favorite Stone?
Well, I have to say Keith.
Right?
Yeah.
What if Brian Jones would have been?
If Brian Jones, who did pass, and that was so, I just saw like a documentary a long time about that, and just about the death of Brian Jones, and where would they be? Because I think Brian did bring in the style and a lot to them that got buried.
Okay, so is it Robert Mitchum or Marlon Brando?
Okay, so I love Brando, and I went to a film festival years ago with Robert Mitchum, and we were both at this film festival, so I got to have a bunch of meals with him, and oh my gosh, he was fantastic. Him and his wife, I think of Dolores, they were married for years and years, and he was just such a character. But they were both great actors.
Muhammad Ali or Mike Tyson?
Muhammad Ali for me. Ali. I have a, where is that? I have a beautiful Muhammad Ali. Where is that? I'll find it.
Meryl Streep or Katharine Hepburn? Hmm. Is that a bad thing? Okay.
No. I mean, I'm just thinking because they're really different and very gifted, and you know, in their time, you know. I mean, Meryl Streep is an extraordinary actress. I love like kind of the offbeat, amazing actresses. You know, like we know like Ellen Barkin. You know, like I love Catherine Keener. I love
Karen Black.
Oh, I loved Karen Black, and she was a really good friend of Alexis, and I met her a few times. And she was Day of the Locust. Do you know that? Did you ever see that film?
I didn't see that.
Okay, John Schlesinger, who directed Midnight Cowboy. John Schlesinger directed Midnight Cowboy. Yes. Okay. And that's what I thought. Okay. And I was like, ooh. But Day of the Locust. Watch this tonight.
Really?
Oh, it's, and that's Karen Black. It's amazing. It's an amazing film.
Was she in, I used to love her, those eyes. And,
yeah.
Oh my God.
Five Easy Pieces she was in.
Yeah, that's pretty, I was
Five Easy Pieces.
I think I liked Jack in that.
I mean, I love them.
He was so great in everything.
Oh yeah. Well, Jack Nicholson, yeah. I loved, I loved Julie Christie, and she mm-hmm. was a great movie star. There's so many really great young people out there too that are up and coming that are really wonderful. But did you see? And we're just talking. By the way, we just lost my favorite actress was for since I was a kid, and Sisley. And when Sounder was one of those great performances, but when I saw the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. When I was
that
a kid,
was great.
That was one of the greatest. That's and she was my cool favorite Oscar. Actress for years, but now it's like Viola.
She had two Oscars.
Huh?
But then, and did you ever see that movie she did with Sammy Davis?
No. What was it?
It was crazy about the jazz. He was a jazz musician. It was tragic. I forget the name of it. They were awesome, both of them.
So there's this restaurant that the Austins used to go to, and I don't know. I wasn't with the Austins. Maybe I was. Was I like. It was years and years ago. It's called Papone's. It's like an old school Italian restaurant. It's in Brentwood, California. And we came in and there was Sicily and Miles sitting there, right there in the front booth. He had like a fur on. They were just like the most dope, beautiful couple you ever saw. And I was so starstruck. And I really wanted to go over and say hello. And everybody said, no, don't bother him. Don't bother him. It was like, as I was going, I was just like, hi.
I was supposed to work on Miles's last album. And
you were?
Yeah. But I couldn't because I was working on Low End Theory at the time. I was in the middle of it. So.
But he reached out to you to do that?
Yeah, I spoke to him. It was so funny because...
See what I'm saying? You are one of the great musicians of all time, see?
Oh, no. but I called him, right? So, hello, Mr. Davis? This is Q-Tip.
Oh.
Q-Tip, I got your number to call you. I just got to say it's an honor to meet you. Hold on. Hey! Who put this? Who's the guy supposed to call? Hey, yeah. What's happening? I was wanting to know if we could, get come to the studio. I was like, did studio session for you? He's like, well, yeah, I heard the record's great. I'd love to talk to you. Just come do a couple of things. And it just never happened.
Oh, man. Wow. But you had that conversation and you knew that he wanted you to do
that. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And then Quincy threw a birthday party for him. It was May at Central Park at the Bow House. Mm. And I remember Kid Capri with his DJ and that thing. And, it was Q and Miles and... And Quincy actually introduced me to Miles. He said, hey, kiss him. Miles. And I'm like, Mr. Davis. He's like, he looked at me and says, well, I like those shoes. Some bad motherfuckers. I was like, thank you, Mr. Davis. Happy birthday. He was like, bang, bang. Somebody took a picture. I want the picture. I don't know.
Oh, Michael could probably find that for you. See if the archives of Quincy somewhere.
Yeah, and then he passed on the day, his funeral, because he passed later on that year in September, and his funeral was on the day that Low End Theory came.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And now I'm working on an album right now with him, posthumously, obviously, but it's an electronic album, and it's going to come out on his birthday. This year,
really? You're making an album that say that
I got a bunch of Miles
stuff. Okay.
from like Bitches Brew up until
which is one of my favorite records ever.
Like all of that electronic stuff. So we just like been, you know, going through getting
that's gonna be crazy great. Can't wait to hear that.
It should be fun.
Miles,
I love him. Miles of Coltrane for you.
Do you stuff with Quincy at all, Q? Your Q, hit the other Q?
It's so cool because, no, I didn't. But yeah, I love him, love Kiana and Sophia, R.I.P. Peggy. And,
you know, I know. She was my friend, Peggy, so for many, many years. And I, of course, know Quincy and the girls, and Rashida's doing so great. I love Kadada is an amazing soul.
But I it's funny because Quest Records, when we were coming out, Quincy called Ali in my band and got Ali to work through A&R in like 1990, I think, for Quest Records. So, you know, I see you sometimes. I'm like, hey, what's up, Pops? I call him Pops sometimes. Hey, man. Q-Tip, how are you, man? How are you? I'm good, man. Man, you remember when I hired you to work for Quest? You don't remember that?
I was like, and it's like every year you have to correct him, but now, you know, I just let him rock. It's like, yes, I remember. I remember, yeah, I remember Pops.
Hey, man, but that was really some good stuff. You work on music, man. You good? You healthy? Good to see you, man.
And that's him, you know?
Yeah.
he's just so dynamic. I'm glad they got him like chilled out and sequestered. You know what I mean? Him and Steve, keep those guys. These are the artifacts that we have.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think Rashida did a, you know, did you see that documentary that Rashida directed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That was great.
She did a great job.
Yeah, she did a great job. Did you see the new one that she did with
Bill Murray?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I didn't see that yet.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's sweet. She's a talent. You were the artistic director for hip hop for the Kennedy Center, is that still exists? Is that still happening?
Yeah.
So what does that entail, being the artistic director for hip hop?
Just trying to come up with programs to put, into the Kennedy Center and to use some of the relationships and stuff to like come up with cool creative ways to put together some, you know, hip hop inspired programming.
What about working and doing music with the beautiful poet Amanda?
She's amazing.
Right?
She reminds me of Lauren.
Right?
Yeah.
Who I interviewed. I got to interview her at Coachella, Lauren Hill. Oh, do I love her. Yes. But what, maybe that's something that you could do, like just take some of her poetry and put music to it and like beats and do something with her. Because I think she's a powerhouse.
Yeah,
and and we're going to be, you know, she's...
You should interview her.
I would love to. Do you know her?
No.
How old is she?
I don't know.
She's
22?
22. She's still a baby. Okay. Yeah. I try to do all kinds of... I mean, I kind of love all religions or whatever works for everybody, and a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and respect what anybody wants to do that centers them and connects them to my Almighty.
That's right.
All right. Well, I guess I'm going to have to say goodbye to you, but can we keep talking? If I come to New York, we got to definitely get together. I'm going to come and play records. Can I invite myself over to your house and go into that room and go through your record collection and play some records? And we got to hang. We have a dinner with Elle and Barkin.
That's right.
Right?
I'll cook.
Oh, please. Okay.
Yeah, I love to cook.
I love her, and I miss her. It's been really hard to be away and isolated, but at least you're on the same coast. But yeah, because I want to get to New York soon and just figure this out. Are you getting this vaccine or what's happening? We don't talk about that. It's kind of...
I'll get it. Once it gets around to being got, I'll get it. I'm not one of those.
You're not in the front lines. Yeah, either. I'm not in the front lines. We're going to wait for the people that really need to have it, like especially... Yeah. Or you know, yeah, it's... Oh, God. I can't believe we're here. We're here.
But it is a wonderful world. We have to... Although these things are kind of murky with, it's pregnant with possibilities right now. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because it's as fall as it's time to rebuild. We're in Aquarius and all that. You know what I'm saying? So
we're officially in the age of Aquarius.
Yeah. So it's time for old shit to fall and new things to blossom.
The lotus that comes up from the mud and blossoms. That's where we're at, right?
That's where we're at.
All right. Q-tip, Kamal. And I want to say,
I'm still pinching myself. I can't believe I'm actually talking.
Oh, I'm pinching me. I was like, I appreciate
now,
you.
Now you're like the Stevie and the Prince.
I appreciate you so much. I appreciate you as an artist and as a man in the world that helps others on many levels. Thank you.
Thank you.
God bless. Talk soon, okay?
Bye.
Okay, honey. All right, bye, honey. Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate and review Radical Musings to help other listeners find the show. And subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast to be alerted every time we post a new episode. Radical Musings is brought to you by Audio Up, produced by Krista Liney and Carla Braun, edited by Jeremiah Zimmerman, production support provided by Ashley Ardent, Sam Winter, Tyler Dorson, Emma Rappold, and Richard Regal.